Welcome to the Global Advocate Career Podcast with your host, Michelle Clark Series.
Well, hello, dear viewers and dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Global Advocate Career Podcast. Today, we're heading over to London to meet with and to introduce you to a dear colleague of mine, someone who I really hold in high esteem and respect enormously. His name is AD, the Artful Dodger, and he is an urban artist. AD, welcome to the Global Advocate Career Podcast.
Thank you, Michelle, and thanks for having me on the show.
Yes, it's such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. So where are you exactly in London? We don't want to give your address away, but where exactly are you?
Basically, Southeast London.
Southeast, yeah. Okay. And what's the weather like over there these days?
Wednesday was good. I mean, it was a little chilly towards the evening, as it always gets towards sundown in the evenings when it's like autumn, winter. But yeah, total blue skies on Wednesday, but now it's not wet, as most people would expect, but it is a little chilly and very cloudy.
So, AD, you know, I'm so excited because you are such a talented artist and your work has been featured in some major locations throughout the world. And tell me, how does it feel to be such a successful artist?
To be honest, I don't think about it. I mean, that may sound a bit weird, but I mean, for the most part, on one level, it's like being a jobbing actor in the sense of I finish one gig or one project and then I move on to the next. I'm not just that, I'm always forward thinking in terms of what I want to do creatively. So I'm not interested in resting on my laurels or talking about or bragging about stuff which I've done. It's like, okay, that's out the way, that's done, on to the next thing, and just keep on generating ideas and things like that. So
now, in growing up, where did you grow up? Did you grow up in London?
Yeah, I grew up in London, in South London. But in pretty much stayed within like a 5 mile or 5 kilometer radius in terms of where I grew up. Yeah, it was kind of different. I mean, yeah, London's known as this multicultural city, but being from an immigrant background in terms of African or Afro-Caribbean, it's a different story.
Yeah, it totally is. It totally is. You know, my husband is British Guyanese and his family's also in Southeast London. And it is a bit of a different world, right? Tell us a little bit about what your biggest impressions were while growing up.
There were many. I mean, culturally, it's because obviously, like one thing that comes to mind is I grew up in like the 70s and 80s as a youth. So it's partly the cultural landscape was totally different.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, I remember when I was in primary school or kindergarten, as some people would call it. When I was like 5 and 6, the teacher would like have a story time at the end of class, like at the end of the school day. And one of the books that she used to read were Sambo stories.
Wow.
But funnily enough, they were set in India. Like, I remember something about Sambo and the tigers. But the thing about it is, as a child, you just take it in. It's just like a fun story to you. You don't necessarily realize the social context. But then again, that's the climate we lived in. And also, like for instance, we had like a brand of jam or jelly, as you call it in America, called Robinson's Jam. And it had like a part of the logo was like a little gollywog.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was in supermarkets and everything. And I know that America has its, you know, that whole Aunt Jemima thing. And
yeah, she just got retired though. So between her and Uncle Ben, they got retired. So they've been released from duties. And you guys had your own. My goodness. It's insane how during those times, the images that we saw every day, right? And just had to accept, you know, degrading images, right?
Yeah, but the thing about it is when you're kind of growing up with that and that's the norm, then a lot of the time you don't question it. because you don't necessarily have a reference point of other. Like, for instance, my parents, they came over here, we were born, and these things were already at play. You know something's not quite right, but you don't have a reference point to say, well, actually, compared to this, you guys shouldn't be doing this, you know, that type of thing. So some things weren't as obvious. And then also it's like, because I have three daughters as well, and they're older now, and, you know, they can't understand when I tell them that being a dark-skinned African growing up in the UK, it was difficult because, you know, in term, because, like, for instance, the school I went to, most of the pupils or the black pupils or whatever were Afro-Caribbean. They're from the Caribbean, most of them were from Jamaica. And Jamaicans did not want to hear anything about Africa. As far as I was concerned, Africa was like this savannah where Africans wore grass skirts and chased lions and zebras all day and lived in mud huts.
Yes.
And so, yeah, and so most of, sorry, you're going to say?
No, please continue.
Yeah, and so their perception, so that's basically what they used to tease me about, you know, oh, you're from Africa, you live in a mud hut, you live in the jungle. And so most of the racist crap I got growing up was from Jamaicans.
Yes. Caribbean consciousness in certain situations, right? I grew up, my family's from Panama, and before that was the West Indies. And I will say that colonialism has done its job very well, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll leave it at that. I'm not going to generalize and say every Caribbean person thinks this way.
Yeah, of course.
Unfortunately, right? This is very pervasive. I actually see on social media attitudes and remarks that still reflect what you just said. But in spite of this, AD, when did you start realizing that you're an artist? When did you start drawing and painting? And how did your environment affect you?
It's something which I always did. One of the weird things was I was like the only artist in our family. Like, I didn't have any aunts or uncles that drew or painted or did sculpture or anything like that. There were no siblings, no parents. So all my reference points and influences came from outside of the family. And I remember, like, when I was a kid, like being like 8 years old, like my parents would say, oh, so when we had like aunts and uncles visit, they'd say, oh, show your painting to such and such. And I'd like stand there with this picture.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And then they'd be saying how good it was. But then when I got to like secondary school age, which you guys would call junior high,
right,
then it changed. Like, my dad says, okay, right, you're at secondary school now. No more going out in the evenings after school. You got to stay home and study. Because I think that was another, back then, that was another big difference between, an obvious difference between Afro-Caribbeans and Africans. Obviously, as you said, there were differences, not speaking of all Afro-Caribbeans or whatever, but it was a thing like where Africans who were over here did put a lot of emphasis on having their children study and do well at school. So yeah, my dad was like, yeah, you're going to study hard, work hard, and then go to university. That was his thing. Mm. And me being a creative, because I mean, I'd been interested in drawing and painting ever since I was like, could hold a pencil. So yeah, I thought, I can't see myself doing that. I mean, even though I was academically able, I mean, I didn't say that to him.
Oh.
There's no way. Otherwise, the belt would have come out.
Yeah, yeah. I think regardless of where we're from in the diaspora, one thing is clear. The belt is a form of discipline. I've exactly. been there. I've also witnessed the broom. We could talk about yeah. that. But yeah. So you didn't fight your parents. You pursued your education. But how did you make your creative side more prominent and then eventually take over, right?
It was something I always had. And for me, I mean, I remember I'd be in my room drawing instead of doing homework. And my dad would like, I could hear my dad coming up the stairs. So I just quickly got a school book, put it over, or a textbook, put it over my drawing and like pretended I was studying and stuff.
Wow.
And he'd like, peeking through the door to make sure I was studying, and then he'd like go back downstairs to watch TV.
But it was, do you think he knew? You think he knew that you were drawing? You think they?
Well, he kind of knew what was up when parents' evening. I used to dread parents' evenings because, and also he had this thing of like in primary school, he would like have these surprise visits where he would just like show up after lunch on some random day during the week. And then he would literally in front of the class kind of like ask the teacher, so yeah, how's he doing?
Really?
And then he would like most of the time would say, oh, well, he's very clever, he's very bright, he's got a lot of potential, but sometimes he likes to play around. And then my dad would just like nod his head and then he'd turn to me and give me a look.
Yes.
Not say anything, just give me a look and then walk out. And I knew that when I got home, I'd be in for a beating that day.
That was it. Now, I'm wondering if your dad and my mom hung out. We'll have to talk about that offline. But, you know, with the strict upbringing, tell us how your art started to grow and when you, you know, decided that this is what you were pursuing as a career.
Well, I've had various interests when I was growing up. I mean, two of my favorite subjects at school were art and English language, because English language was basically about creative writing, and I loved that. But then when I was about 14, I fell in love with architecture. And architecture was like, wow, I want to be an architect. So I told my dad, and obviously he was like very proud of me, and mm-hmm. he didn't say it, but he was okay with that. But even in primary school, we used to have like projects where each term we'd have to pick a different subject mm-hmm. to do a project on for that term, which would get to do like a few hours a week in class. And that was great. That was like when I was about 10 years old. And so I did one on like airplanes. I did one on Native Americans. I did one on like houses. And I remember I kind of spent the whole day with like a pencil and ruler drawing out the titles and trying to make it as good as possible. So an interest in creative lettering was there. Then I got into calligraphy when I was about 14 through our art teacher. He introduced a whole class to it. But then like traditional calligraphy with like pen and inks and nibs sure. and stuff. But most people were just interested in like flicking ink at each other and using the nibs as darts and throwing them across the room. But I kind of like really liked it. And I came to the teacher, he says, right, that's it. You guys aren't doing this anymore. But then I came to him after class and says, look, can I do some more? Because I'm really interested in this. At first he was skeptical, but then he knew I like to be creative. And so he says, okay, I'll give you a few alphabets. I'll lend you some inks, make sure you look after them, some pens, and then bring them back next week and see what you can do. I started basically every night, I was like practicing, and then I brought him like these sheets. And I think I kind of surprised him because I didn't think he thought I'd come back with something.
Sure.
And I had like 10 samples of stuff to show him, and he was like really impressed. And so I was like, okay, that's good for a start. Let me show you some more stuff. So he gave me some more stuff and like showed me some books, which I could like get into. And yeah, and then I started to like go to the library and get books out on calligraphy and then the interest in architecture was there, but as a career, I started looking at some form of creative lettering, possibly sign writing. Then I remember when I was 16, because that's when we left school, just before I was 16, like our last year of school, we used to have almost like a careers week, where we'd have like, where our year would have like a careers advisor who would like come in, and she'll talk to the pupils on a sure. one-to-one basis with a parent about what they wanted to do and the options, whether it be like go straight into employment, go to college, go to uni, that sort of thing, if we needed any further exams. And I remember I'd gotten interested in graphic design probably about maybe 9 months before that. So I thought that's what I want to be because it combines creativity with art and lettering and stuff. I want to design logos and record covers mm-hmm. and stuff. Yeah. And so, yeah, we sat down, my dad came in and she says, yeah, so what do you want to do? And I just looked at her and says, I want to be a graphic designer. And then my dad just like slow, who was sitting next to me, he just slowly turned and gave me, I didn't look at him, but I could see his eyes just burning into the side of my face.
Wow.
And then when we got, and then she started talking about art colleges and what I could apply for and stuff. And then when we got home, my dad just sat me down and says, look, if you go to art college, I don't want anything to do with it. I'm not going to go to any meetings. I'm not going to sign any forms, nothing.
Is that what your dad said? And so yeah. What did you decide?
Well, I kind of felt like an outsider in the family anyway. So I thought, well, fine. It's fine by me. I'm going to go. So I went to art college and for about a year. And then when I was there, that's when I kind of started to read about what was happening on the walls and trains in New York in terms of aerosol writing that some people call graffiti or graffiti art.
Right. So, okay. So, you know, listening to you say aerosol writing sounds so much more alluring than graffiti, right? Now, I grew up in the 70s. I grew up in New York City in the 70s and 80s. And I remember particularly in the 70s, the trains were all covered with tags, graffiti. Mm-hmm. What did you tag back in the day? Or did you, you know, were you on, you know, walls? And like, how did you start developing that?
Well, it's kind of weird because when I started doing calligraphy, people just, because I was already known as like the sci-fi geek. I was like one of those quiet geeky kids that like to draw and paint type of thing. And, you know, and so that already kind of like made me an outsider mm-hmm. or even more of an outsider. Mm-hmm. So I used to love, one thing I loved about calligraphy was doing like the big illuminated letters on this page of like middle-aged manuscripts or medieval manuscripts.
Sure.
I saw you just be poring over the pages of those in books and looking at the swirls and the colors and the gold leaf and stuff like that. And that's why I used to copy. So I think when I start to read about what was going on and happening on the trains in New York, I think I made a subconscious connection between what medieval scribes were doing and what these kids were doing in New York, because basically it was like the same thing, but using a different medium and a different surface. They're still painting big, bright, colorful letters with swirls and, you know, additions and embellishments. So I think when I saw that and read about that, I thought, that's what I want to do.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I just thought, yep, that's what I want to do. And then, one thing that made me stand out when I started was I did, because of the calligraphy background, mm-hmm. I used to tag my name in a Gothic style. Mm. And so I just kind of, and I was getting into the hip hop scene as well, and that kind of like really made me popular because no one else was doing that. Everyone was like doing like a handwriting style, and here's me coming with like a calligraphic tag that looked like it had been printed onto a wall.
So did you tag in public places at all? Did you ever do that?
Yeah, I mean, the weird thing is I spoke to a guy who interviewed me about 6 months ago, and he was saying that he did interviews with other writers from the time, from like the mid-80s, and a couple of them that got caught, they says that when they were being questioned by the police, they're like, the police were saying, are you the Artful Dodger? Tell us who he is, tell us. And I thought, whoa. Because the thing about it is, even though I had a calligraphic tag, I was up. I was tagging just as much as other writers. I mean, it may have taken longer, but I was basically tagging just as much as other writers in the same sort of places. So yeah, my tag was out there, definitely.
Now, you know, I remember, you know, I went to Catholic school. So The friends that I knew that were tagging, right? Obviously it's not their name, it's their alias. It's whatever the pseudonym is, right? And I remember it was a big thing. It's like, oh my gosh, there's Nelson's tag, or there's that person's tag. And this usually happened. My mother was super strict, so I could not go out at night. So, but this usually happened in the late evening, wee hours of the morning when the trains were in the yard, when nobody was around. Is that mm-hmm. around the same time that you used to tag?
No. Well, yes and no. I mean, one side was we did that, used to go out at night, and because I was more into like being walls than trains. I mean, some people did both. Some people like train writers, some people wall writers. But yeah, my thing was like doing water, like the creative side and the tagging side. Obviously, like getting up, getting your name around is like the core element of aerosol writing, the nucleus of it. But yeah, I just love going out and doing pieces. And yeah, for me, that was like something that I love. So the pieces were done at night. And like the tags, they were done sometimes at night, sometimes in the daytime. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like whenever there's no one around looking, you just put up a tag.
I mean, I think it's, first of all, I think it's so risky, but it's also exciting, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, did you ever run into someone else tagging? And how did that interaction work out?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you'd see someone's tag, and a common thing to do, if you see someone's tag, you put your tag next to it.
Oh.
And there was another guy who was like tagging called Crash151. That was his tag. And I used to see his tag everywhere, not just like on trains or whatever, or train stations, but on walls, subways, all sorts of things. And so I'd always put my tag next to his, but I never knew who he was. I never saw him. And funnily enough, they used to like hip hop jam on Sundays, like for like kids, like we used to like go to.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was chatting with this guy, and we'd like see each other. We didn't know each other's names as such, but we just like used to chat about the music. And then I says, "Oh, you write? Oh, what do you write?" And he says, "Oh, Crash151.
Oh,
go, what? That's oh, you." And it kind of blew my mind, because I'd like, here's me chatting to this guy for weeks. I didn't even know that A, he was a writer, and B, what his tag was. So yeah, and then after that, he says that he wanted to form like a South London super crew.
Oh.
Where he wants to get like five other writers who are like the best in South London with like individual skills, and put together a crew that would like take out everybody.
Oh my gosh. So this is like the battle of the crews, right? Right, AD? Yeah. Like, this is serious. Like, this is like urban, you know, warfare. and there's rules to tagging, right? Like, you don't tag over someone else's name, right?
Yeah, unless you want to have beef with them or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But then again, you do get some people who, if they consider a newcomer a toy, which is basically someone who's inexperienced, then they will tag them as if, say, you shouldn't be tagging around here because you're just a beginner type of thing. So you'll get that pecking order. But I mean, a lot of it is that whole macho kind of like, you know, strutting your stuff type of thing, ego-based. There is that.
Any female taggers that you know of?
There was a few. I mean, there used to be like a crew back in the day who were like just female writers, but there weren't many. I mean, it was a lot more popular in other countries. Like, I was hearing about whole crews, not just like one crew, but like crews of female writers in places like Australia and Germany and France, and obviously like the States as well.
So, okay, so you're tagging, you know, you got that notoriety on, you know, on the street. And I'm not saying, you know, this is a good thing. That's how you start. When did you start, I'm not going to say mainstreaming, but when did you start mainstreaming?
there was a youth club centre wall in Peckham where me and another guy called Plaz used to paint at night. And like, I painted my initials in big letters on the wall. And then I heard from someone who went to the youth centre that I knew, saying that, oh, the guy that runs the youth centre wants you to paint the whole wall.
Oh.
But being like a writer, mainly doing illegal stuff, I thought it like a trap. You know, so I thought, nah, he's just like trying to find it for you. So he can like catch people. He's super paranoid. But then he says, I kept meeting him, and he says, look, this guy wants you to come in and talk to us. Okay, I'll have a basic meeting with him and see what he says. And yeah, he was totally up for it. He says, look, we can't afford to pay you, but we can pay for materials. And it was a big wall. I mean, it was like about 12 foot high and about 50 foot across. And it took me and Plaz like a week to paint it. But we did it, and it was like the best piece I'd done at the time. So that kind of got some street cred for that. And like on the last day, there was like a local news reporter came down to write an article for like a food newspaper. And he put my, I didn't know he was going to do this, but he put my name and phone number at the end saying, oh, if anyone wants any work from AD, here's his number. Here. And I freaked out when I saw that because I thought, what are you doing?
Oh, man.
The police could see this, blah, blah. So it was a thing of like where for like the next couple of months, I was just like super paranoid. Like if I was like, because I'd like step to like 3 a.m, sketching, practicing, that sort of thing. And if I heard like a car slow down, I just like quickly turn off the lights.
Yeah.
Look out the window to see who it was, to see if it was like the police. And then one day I got a call in the daytime from someone says, oh, is the Artful Dodger there? And I says, no, who's this? And he says, oh, well, I'm an art director for a company that does like ads and I'm looking for him to possibly do like some work for us.
Oh.
He says, oh, well, this is him. So what is it? And then, yeah, so he invited me down to his office and it was like this advertising company in the city. And they did the ads for the Weetabix commercials. So they basically wanted me to do a painting that was good before on billboards all around the country.
Wow.
And so I didn't really want to do it at first, strangely enough, because my thing was, well, I'm a writer and writers, you know, we just do stuff on the streets and stuff. And I said to him, well, I'll be able to put my name on it. And he says, yeah. So I thought, fine, I'm doing it.
There you go.
Because I just saw that as like national fame. So yeah. And then it kind of like started off from there.
Now, you went on to do film. And tell us about working with Idris Elba.
Oh, that was basically, I mean, I never got to meet him, sadly, because I really loved his films at the time. But a few, about 2 years ago, there was one of the main channels over here called Channel 4.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing like a summer season of urban-based movies and like documentaries and features based around BMXing, street art, skateboarding, and urban music as well. So they just want to like basically do a whole summer season of films and documentaries on urban life. And one documentary they made, I think it's called How Hip Hop Ruled the World or something like that. And I did some work for that and they got Idris Elba to narrate it. But, you know, I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to get to meet him, but I never got to meet him, sadly.
So, okay. So you're blowing up, right? Mm-hmm. You're now, you know, doing your work in more established mediums, right? In more established environments. What's your family saying about this? What's your mom and dad saying about this?
My dad never really gave his opinion about it. I think he probably, I mean, his thing was, yeah. I remember him constantly saying, you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. You know, that typical African career path thing. You know, it's kind of like anything with a suit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
thing. Whereas my mom, I mean, I remember when I first started writing and I used to tag near where I lived and she knew I did calligraphy. So when she saw my tag, she just knew it was me. But she just told me, look, I know what you're doing. And if you get caught and the police come here, I'm just going to tell them I don't know you. And she was serious, so, you know. But I mean, she's proud of me now, obviously, but I think in hindsight, I think there's mixed feelings about it because a part of it's like, your parents just want you to have some form of security in terms of a career and then being able to provide for a family as you get older, that type of thing, like what they try to strive for. And also they want you to do better than them. But also there's a part of it which is like, I'm kind of making it now, but you didn't support me when I perhaps could have used the help and support. And B, it's almost like their failings or their insecurities, they're kind of like putting on your shoulders.
Yes.
To the point where you're kind of like living this life. It's more about them and their failings than it is about you and your potential.
I mean, I think that's a fair point. I think it's a fair point. I think for some, it debilitates them. For others, it galvanizes and empowers them. With you, it empowered you. You know, keeping in mind their concerns with law enforcement, did you ever have any confrontations with the police back then?
a couple, like Claire's, who lived in an area called Peckham, which was a really rough area back then. I mean, it's a place where if you didn't know anybody, you didn't walk through there at night.
Sure.
But because of me painting there, and because I knew Claire's, it was like people knew who I was and what I was about. It was a thing of like where I could walk there 2-3 in the morning and I wouldn't get any hassle. You know, I felt safe. Mm-hmm. And most people would not. It was a sort of place where before they knocked it down, it's like basically like it was one of the biggest projects, housing projects in Europe. It was pretty big and also with thousands of people living in it. And yeah, it got to one point where they were so desperate for people to live there, they were offering people 2 months free rent.
Really?
Yeah. Just to live
and
there.
Now look at Peckham.
Exactly. Totally gentrified. Well, pretty much mostly gentrified.
Yep.
Yeah.
So when you encountered law enforcement, was it confrontational? Was it questioning? Was it like, how was it?
It was questioning. I mean, yeah. I mean, I remember once Claire's came around to mine in the evening. We were like skating to like 3 in the morning. And then it was like summer. So we were like walking back to his to get a few cans of paint because I had like a bag of paint with me. We says, oh, let's get some more. So we're walking to his, and like about 10 minutes before we got to his, this police officer was like doing his rounds and says, hey guys, what's in the bag? You know, he wasn't kind of like aggressive or anything. He was just asking what's in the bag. Cause I was like two African, Afro-Caribbean guys walking through South London at 3 in the morning with a bag.
It's takeout, officer.
Yes, I says, oh yeah, we've got paint. And I just opened the bag and showed him the bag of spray paint. And says, yeah, we're going to be painting in a Covent Garden. We're going to be doing some artwork there. So I'm just going to like stay at his place for the rest of the night. And then we're going to go there in the morning and paint. And he says, oh, and says, look, we haven't been painting. You can see that the cans are still full. I don't have any paint stains on my hands or on my clothes. So I says, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, good luck with it. And he let us go.
Well done.
I mean, but it was that whole thing of like, for me, confronting the police was almost like confronting parents, where you've got to learn to think fast. If you get questioned, you think fast. Because
as a parent, I can relate. As we are both parents,
because if you don't give them the right answer, trouble's coming.
yes, and so, you know, you have gone on to feature your work in some major locations. I mean, you recently also commissioned a portrait for the Deputy Speaker of the House of Commons. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was because my whole thing was giving back because, I mean, yeah, I was kind of like on a trajectory of my artwork and no fame or becoming infamous, whatever you want to call it. But then in the back of my mind was not forgetting where I came from and realizing that there's thousands of not just African or Afro-Caribbean kids, but immigrant kids whose parents want them to take a safe route in terms of a career and establishing the foundations for building a family on. So I know that there's probably a lot of kids out there that are creative and, you know, but they just don't have the support they need, because paths aren't always clear. And this was like obviously pre-internet, pre a lot of things where the support just wasn't there. So I kind of wanted to do that, but I didn't know how to do it. And I remember once I got interviewed by a guy who was like writing an article for an independent newspaper, not an independent magazine, like a zine type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I was like on my little ego trip, you know, in my late teens and saying, oh, my name is gonna be in the paper again, blah, 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 I'm doing this interview. And then when I read the article, it was good. But then towards the end of it, for the conclusion, he wrote that, you know, Britain has like a long history of like political and community or social based art, like social commentary. And then he cited a few examples and it says, but now you've got these kids, which some of them are talented and all they're doing is going around painting their name. What a waste.
Wow.
And at first I thought, how dare you, blah, blah. But then when I kind of like calmed down, I said, well, actually, he's right. Here we are, this group of young people who are communicating in a medium that young people understand, that young people are into. And we're speaking to other young people. So why aren't we saying more? Why aren't we saying things or painting things which addresses the concerns and issues that young people face and go through? So in a way, I began to see, well, actually, writers, aerosol writers, could be almost like politicians for the young. I mean, for me, politics is a dirty word, but that was the kind of thing I came up with. And so I began to be more socially conscious and then kind of want to give something back. So I began to do workshops with young people,
right,
where I'd like to teach them how to spray paint, and then we'll get to do a mural at the end of it. And some of it would be just like a way of them to like let off steam, explore their creative side. And other times it was like a way of them exploring deeper issues, like teen pregnancy, smoking, drugs, that type of thing, you know.
Wow, so it made you become more involved in the community, and the commissioned portrait, which was the first piece of urban art to ever be featured in Parliament, is it still there?
I don't know, because the way I got that was I used to be a patron for a youth arts education and employment charity called Futureversity. They were based in London. They started off by doing projects with young people in the summer, just like a summer project program. But then they realized, because they're based in East London, Tower Hamlets. And Tower Hamlets, in that borough, you've got Canary Wharf, which is like London's financial center. So they realized that it's basically the richest borough in the day doing the trade, because of the whole traders and the financial aspect of it. But then when those traders go home, there's just like the people left there who live in like the social housing aspect of it. So basically, literally, it was like the richest borough during the day, but the poorest borough in London by night. And so they set up Futureversity as a way of addressing that. And then once they started doing summer programs, then they began to reach out to some of these bankers and say, look, you're basically working in a borough with all these young people who don't have opportunities. Why not do something with them? Why not? And so they start to have like taking people who are like about to leave school that were interested in finance, doing internships with some of the companies there. And it became like really successful. And one thing which they did to raise money is that they had like a fundraiser. One evening at the Savoy Hotel. It was like a dinner where tickets were sold for like £100 each. They invited bankers and basically like a whole Rolodex of people that they knew. And as a patron, they asked me if I could contribute something to be auctioned off, because that was going to be a big auction. And I says that I'd basically donate a commission. So they'd basically sell the commission, and then whoever bought it, whatever they wanted me to paint, I'd paint for them. So guy who became successful businessman who ended up becoming a good friend of mine, Hugh Shakeshaft, he was there that night. He ended up buying the commission. We met afterwards, became good friends. And then he decided to donate it to a good friend of his, which was Nigel Evans, a former Deputy Speaker of the House of Commons. And so that's how I ended up getting that gig.
That's fantastic. Now, not only have you made significant headway in the UK, you have also been to other countries. Tell us about your experience abroad.
Yeah. Basically, when Britain was part of the European Union, it was eligible to do projects. And one thing which wasn't widely publicized over here was the fact that there were funding streams which would basically fund projects which would promote and kind of strengthen European unity between European countries. So like, for instance, if someone wanted to have like an exchange project between Britain and France or France and Germany, they could apply, they could put a project proposal together and then get funding for it. And so one that I was on, was invited to do, was like a street art one, which was going to be based in Ukraine. And it was a thing of like where they invited 7 countries to participate with 6 young people aged between like 16 and 24 and one project leader. So I was invited to like get a project group of young people together and also be the project leader. So yeah, you had a whole bunch of people from 7 different countries scheduled to head to the Ukraine. But that was like 2015 when that project was due to happen.
Right.
And that was when you had the trouble in Ukraine and the capital city, Kiev.
Yeah. So did anything happen? Was anything able to continue?
It was difficult because, you know, and also you had like the European football championships happen, which were staged in Eastern Europe, one of the countries being Ukraine, like a year or two before that. And then, so I was like doing research into what Ukraine was like, because I didn't know much about it. And then you had the British Caribbean former captain of the English football team saying, Black people don't go to Ukraine, you'll end up coming home in a body bag.
Oh.
Because of the level of high levels of violence and racism that the British Afro-Caribbean football players experienced out there.
Very bad.
So yeah, I was reading that on one hand, and then I was thinking, oh, wow. And then on the other hand, it was like, I'm reading in the press about civil war in Ukraine. It's like, so trying to get young people to go was difficult. Because like, I knew like some Caribbean people and they said, oh yeah, I'm doing a project in Eastern Europe. It's free, all expenses paid. Do you want to come participate? Yeah, hey, it sounds great. Where is it? Ukraine. What was that? Ukraine. I'm not going there. I'll get killed, blah, blah.
Oh man.
And then even like European or Caucasian people, I'd ask them and it's like, they'd ask their parents and the parents say, no, the civil war. And even the media was like, talking about this whole civil war in Ukraine.
Yes.
But I was like in direct contact with the project leader in Ukraine, and she was saying, look, where the project's going to be is a small city called Sumy, which is 5 hours north of Ukraine. And also not just that, where the airplane lands is basically a place called Borispol, which is outside of Kiev anyway. And all the trouble's in Kiev. So when we actually flew over there, mm-hmm. there was, yeah, we didn't encounter anything.
And how were the people? How did the people treat you?
Yeah, that's obviously was a big concern. But yeah, the people were like really warm and friendly. It was a great experience. But obviously, like because of the media reports, most of the participants that were supposed to be there from other countries didn't go.
Yes, you know, I'm glad that you went. I'm glad that you did what you did, because unfortunately, sometimes the media, it seems like most of the time, the media blows things up to such a proportion that it is completely not the case. I mean, I'm glad that you did it. Tell us about the award that you got from the late Princess Diana.
Yeah, that was like on, there used to be a housing estate called the Aylesbury. And that was another huge housing estate in social housing estate in Southeast London. One project that I was doing there, it was we decided to like be one of the wall murals on drugs. And so one of the young people came up with the slogan "Crack cracks you up," because that was like beginning. That was like the 80s, and so crack was like beginning to
right
get big. Now this is like the early 90s, yeah. And so, yeah, we did a mural of it. And then there happened to be a drugs awareness competition happening locally in the borough. And so we, it was London-wide. And then we just like, okay, we'll submit pictures of what we did, of like the kids painting and then the mm-hmm. final mural. And yeah, we realized, we were told a few weeks later that it had been submitted to this awards thing and that we'd won.
So wow. Like, Did you ever meet Lady Diana?
No, because that's when, sometimes when you do projects, there's politics. Because I was chosen, because of my experience with urban art, it was like an urban art project. I was chose to be the coordinator, which basically meant that I got paid more than the youth workers, and they didn't like that. They thought, this guy's only the coordinator because he can paint. He's got no youth work experience, even though I had like good people skills and I could communicate very well with young people, but they just didn't like that. So when the award thing came up, they didn't even tell me.
Really?
Yeah. So I didn't find out until like about a week later.
Oh my goodness, AD.
I know. So they got to like go to the award ceremony and they got to meet her, but yeah.
Wow. Did you circle back to someone and say like, that's wrong? Did you say anything?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was really annoyed because I would have loved to have met her and, you know, I mean, to have a project that you did be up for award and be recognized and for the young people involved to be recognized, especially knowing that those young people are from deprived inner city is great. But, you know, the award ceremony was like a cherry. It was like the cherry on the cake to a great project, you know, but it was like, oh, well, there weren't enough tickets. And I thought, I'm the coordinator. I should have been like one of the main people there.
I bet you're not involved with that organization anymore, right?
No.
Yeah. Well, you've done bigger and better things. So kudos to you for handling that. Before we go on to my section of, let's go to my section called Wait What, where I ask some interesting questions, hoping to get some interesting responses. You ready?
Yep.
All right. The Dodgers are what kind of team in U.S. sports?
That would be the Brooklyn Dodgers, and I'll say they're a baseball team.
You are correct. They were initially known as the Brooklyn Dodgers. They are now the L.A. Dodgers.
Wow. Okay.
Good. Next question. What does it mean to dodge a bullet?
To miss out on an embarrassing or dangerous or situation that's not good.
You are correct, AD. Thank you. Next question. The Charger, the Challenger, and the Durango are cars made by which corporation?
Could you say those names again?
Sure. The Charger, the Challenger, and the Durango are car makes of cars made by which corporation?
Is it Chrysler?
No.
It's either Chrysler or Ford, I think.
No, it's the Dodge Corporation.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get a pattern here, right? Have you actually ever had to get out of Dodge?
Actually, that's one thing I'm working on now. Yeah, because I mean, the way I see it, London is gradually turning into Gotham.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, for those that know, Gotham is like the city that Batman fights crime in, and there's Arkham Asylum, and you've got the Joker, and you know. But yeah, and the Joker is Boris Johnson, as far as I am concerned, or Bojo the Clown, as I call him.
Yeah, see, that's his nickname over there, it seems.
Yeah, a lot of things have taken place over the past 18 months that shouldn't have happened. There's politics have been leading this thing, politics have been the face of it, but corporations have been driving it.
Right.
And a lot of people don't want to see that. I think a lot of people still want to take the blue pill and think that everything's going to work out fine. I mean, how can you have faith in a leader that's constantly lying to you, who has a history of lying to you, has a history of nepotism, et cetera, and what, all of a sudden he's to be believed now? No, once a liar is always a liar. I mean, or people can be turned. I mean, it's like even in America, the people thought that Biden would be like the antidote to the Trump administration. And in my thing, like the way I look at it, like what people say, he's worse. Hmm. I mean, my friend Hugh Shakeshaft, who I mentioned before, he's a fan of the former British Prime Minister and statesman Winston Churchill. Right. And he says that Churchill's reported to have said that, show me a person who's, show me an 18-year-old who's a, yeah, show me an 18-year-old who's a conservative and I'll show you someone without a heart.
Wow.
Show me a liberal age 40 and I'll show you someone without a brain.
Yeah, so Winston Churchill, you know, his, there have been efforts to deface his statues and others in the UK that symbolize oppression and racism. What are your thoughts about people defacing historical figures?
I think this one thing I'm not interested in is this whole thing of trying to retrofit history. Winston Churchill was a man of his time. Regardless of whether you agree with his politics or whatever, he was a defender, he was a soldier, he was a naval commander, he was a defender of the British Empire. That's what, and at that time, there was a British Empire, regardless of what you like to think or not, that's, yeah. So he was a man of his time, and that needs to be taken into context, rather than saying, oh, what he did back then. Yeah, we know that now, but what happened, happened, and also, he was a big reason why Britain kind of like won the war on the sea in terms of World War.
Sure,
and absolutely. That, you know, he did some great things for this country. People can do great things, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're good people. And I think there needs to be a difference, or it needs to be differentiated between great and good, because they're not synonymous with each other. And I think he should be respected for his achievements. But obviously, yeah, he was a man of his time. So obviously I don't agree with his politics, but I'm not going to say his statue should be taken down, because that's like, okay, we know that to a certain extent, history has been whitewashed. What's he going to start blackwashing history now? What's that about?
So that's interesting. That's interesting. You know, a statue of George Floyd went up in New York City and was subsequently defaced. It's since been cleaned up. Do you think that having statues of, you know, African American or civil rights leaders or people that represent, you know, what the Black Lives Movement now is all about would be helpful?
That is a Pandora's box of a question.
It is.
I don't, as far as I'm concerned, George Floyd doesn't represent me. And if people think that George Floyd represents a majority of African Americans or Black Americans, then they need to look in the mirror and think what they're saying. Because for the most part, George Floyd was a career criminal. I mean, I know how I'm part of one of his crimes was to hold a gun to the belly of a pregnant woman. So I know how I'd feel if he did that to my daughter or mother or sister. So my thing is, why are you defending this person, really? I mean, I can understand in terms of the way he died, he should never have died that way. But the thing is, there are more fitting people to march for or protest about. You know, it's like, why are we kind of like making martyrs out of criminals? We continually do this. Who does that? No one else does that, as far as I know. Takes a criminal in their community and makes a martyr out of them. That's like saying, this is the best example we have of what a martyr is. No, that's bullshit. I'm not accepting that at all. And as far as the Black Lives Matter, as a concept, I agree with it. As a movement, it's fake, as far as I'm concerned. Because I've been on the Black Lives Matter website and I've read their about section, and the fact that they're talking about wanting to dismantle or do away with the traditional form of family. Okay, one of the biggest problems in not just the African-American community, but the Afro-Caribbean community over here in Britain and in the diaspora in general, mm-hmm. is the absence of fathers, or fathers which are fathers. And so we need them in the family. We need family units where fathers are there and present in their children's lives. We know it makes a difference. So why are we supporting an organization that wants to do away with that?
Interesting, interesting. Which leads me to ask you, AD, if you were requested to commission a work, to do a work for someone who you did not agree with in terms of what they stood for politically or personally, would you do it?
Give me a literal example.
If I asked you to do a work and you know that my history is dicey, I probably, you know, there's talk that I may have been complicit to a crime. I have a racist background, you know, dicey, you know,
It's difficult. That is difficult because it's like the whole thing of people digging up tweets that people may have tweeted when they're teenagers or 10, 15 years ago, whatever, and putting those out. People, what they have said, what they said then may not necessarily be how they feel now. Are you still going to judge their current state on their past state? You know, because those people putting other people on blast, how would they feel if the same was done to them? Because some people putting other people on blast about it are guilty of the same thing. So I think it would be like each case on its merits. I mean, if a person was like that now, then no. Like, for instance, Boris Johnson, nah. Someone like that. Biden, nah. No. Absolutely not.
Speaking and of...
The interesting thing about Biden is that, I mean, my whole thing is, and other people who are like skeptical of this whole scamdemic thing is follow the money. Money leads to motive. And then you find people's true intentions and things. I mean, like, for instance, I remember someone telling me that it was Gates that bankrolled Biden's electoral campaign. Now, after Biden got elected, that's when Pfizer announced that they had a cure. And why do you think Biden's pushing to get everyone vaxxed? Because he's beholden.
I think it's an interesting perspective. I think it's an interesting perspective. And I know that I have colleagues and friends who question the times that we're in right now. You mentioned then and now. Here's another question for you. What was the first hip hop song ever? Do you remember?
It depends. I mean, commercially, it would be Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang.
You are correct.
But before that, there was the Fatback Band's King Tim III.
Really?
That's officially the first hip hop song.
King Tim III.
Yeah, by the Fatback Band.
By Fatback. Okay, yes.
And that came out before Rapper's Delight.
Yeah, Fatback, I love their song, I Found Love. That, yes, okay, thank you. You see? Getting school today. True or false, AD, graffiti was invented, so they say, by some guy named Cornbread.
Yep, in Philadelphia.
Oh, so you agree with that?
Yeah, I think he started writing Cornbread, I think it was 1965, because he wanted to impress a girl called Cynthia.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we hope we got her, but... if he didn't, he still lucked out. Which leads me to ask you, are you in touch with Crash 151 and Plaz?
Plaz I saw by chance last week, as a matter of fact. I mean, he still lives in Peckham. He's like, works and like looks after his brother who has a disability. Mm-hmm. So, but Crash, I've not seen him for years.
All right, Crash 151, if you come across this podcast, Reach out. Next question, Montana Black or Krylon?
Krylon was scarce over here, but Montana Black, that's a good brand.
That's a good brand of spray paint? Okay. Do you prefer tagging on brick walls or painting on brick walls or concrete?
Concrete's better. Definitely, because like that smooth surface, it's easier to prime if you have to prime the wall first. And also, when you're taking photos with the sunlight, you know, you don't have like the shadows of the bricks and stuff. It's just a better, smoother surface to paint on, definitely.
Concrete. Oil or acrylic?
Acrylic.
Do you prefer baseball cap or spray cap?
spray cap.
Nitrile gloves or polyester gloves?
Polyester.
And if someone just happens to get graffiti on their wall, what's the best way to get it out?
Depends. If it's concrete or like if it's plaster, then you can maybe sandblast it. That's one thing. You can paint over it. Or if it's done by a famous artist, then hey, you could basically sell your house.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. So AD, tell us, you know, as we close, what's next for you? I know you mentioned you're considering maybe moving out of the country, but how can we find out more about you? What's going on?
At the moment, I'm doing a series of urban art projects on a three South London social housing projects or estates, as we call them here. Mm-hmm. So I'm busy with that. I may have an exhibition next year, but I'm looking to get into NFTs, which is non-fungible tokens, the whole digital, you know, art market. So I'm exploring that at the moment. I mean, I've got a couple of interesting projects in the works in terms of producing artwork, which is going to be turned into NFTs. So I'm just getting the sketches together, getting the designs together, and yeah, watch the space.
Yeah, I definitely want to watch the space. Now, I myself have been, you know, painting a bit and drawing a bit. And, you know, artists online have their YouTube channels. They provide lessons. You know, you see them on Instagram. Is that where you think you're headed in some form or fashion?
YouTube channel, not for now. I mean, I like to do more mass produced stuff, like in terms of prints, posters, T-shirts. Funnily enough, I've been wanting to do T-shirts for years, but just never got around to do it. But being a one-person industry can be difficult because you've got to take care of the PR, the promotion, the creative side, the admin, all that stuff. It's a lot. So, I mean, what would be good is if I had an agent or a manager to take care of the business side so that I could focus more on developing the creative. Because I've got so many ideas, but there's just not enough hours in the day, sadly. Yeah. I mean, a part of me wishes I could clone myself, but then that's another story.
That's another story, AD. That's another story. AD, I want to say we could talk all day, and I want to say thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to share your experiences, how you became such a phenomenal artist. It just felt really good to talk to you about tagging and uh-huh. You know, I didn't even ask you, have you ever tagged in New York or any city in the United States?
No, and to be honest, I don't think I would.
Oh, why is that?
I'd like to, but because of the illegal aspects of it, it's potentially what could happen. Wouldn't want to take that chance.
Yeah, you know what? You're actually right. So we're looking forward to having you come over and do some exhibitions. And
I'd love to
feature your artwork over here. AD, I thank you again, my dear brother, for coming on the show. It has been such a pleasure. It's such a pleasure to hear your perspective. And I wish you the very, very best. Thanks again. Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Until next time, see you later.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Global Advocate Career Podcast with your host, Michelle Clark Series. Love the episode? Please head over to Google Podcast, Spotify, and other listening platforms. Subscribe, rate, and give a review. Until next week, cheers.